Georgia's DBHDD reminds people that the Good Samaritan Law can save lives during alcohol and drug overdoses. People are urged to call 911 and stay until help arrives. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Welcome to another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. One day closer to Thanksgiving. I hope you've got your turkeys thawing in the refrigerator, because if you don't have them ready to go quite yet, it's going to be hard to thaw them in time for Thursday. We do not offer tips, however, beyond saying get them out of the freezer. We are not a turkey hotline. We have a lot of really important and in much of what we're going to talk about today, very somber news about politics and events of the day. So let's get right to that. Tamar Hallerman is here. She is always on Tuesday. She's the senior reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hello, Tamar. How are you?
Hey, Bill. Broadcasting in from my parents' house in Virginia, so my connection's a little iffy sometimes. That's why.
Oh, okay. Well, you sound terrific so far, and I'm glad you're already up there with your family for the holiday. Good for you. Rene Alegria is back with us. He's the CEO of Mundo Hispanico Digital, and we're, of course, glad to have you back here, Rene. How are you? Are you getting set for the holiday?
Oh, thank you for having me back, Bill. Absolutely. I mean, I think I, like so many others, are ready to cannonball into a bowl of gravy.
Okay, well, be sure to get a picture of that for us, Rene. Andra Gillespie is here. You know, she's a professor of political science at Emory University, and is also the director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory. Hello, Andra. How are you?
I am fine. How are you?
I'm good. Are you... Is the news such right now that it's hard to get into a holiday mood? Do you have, you know, is it kind of weigh on you a little bit?
No, I've learned to compartmentalize there. The thing that makes it hard for professors to get into the holiday spirit is that it's the end of the semester, so the holidays always suck because I have stuff to grade. So,
God,
and that's
great.
You know, true for Christmas too. It just delays anything that I can do.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. Thomas Wheatley is back with us. It's been a while since Thomas has been on the show, and he is now with Axios Atlanta, which is pretty new to our market. Of course, many of you who are political junkies have been getting the national Axios newsletter for some time, but now they have an Atlanta version, and Thomas, you are there. How's it going so far for you over at Axios?
It's going great. The response has been incredible. It's a wonderful time to launch. There's so much happening. There's almost too much happening. And next year is just going to guarantee to deliver more. So
yeah.
Trying to stay rested.
Well, thank you for being with us. Tamar, we've got to start with the Arbery murder trial going on right now. We know at closing arguments, the prosecution and the defense gave their closing arguments throughout the day yesterday. This morning, Linda Donikoski will have a chance as prosecutor to do a rebuttal. She has been given, I think she's been given up to 2 hours for her rebuttal. Yesterday, she was very efficient in her closing. She spoke for like an hour and a half and turned it over to the defense. So we don't know how long her rebuttal will take today. After that, the judge will have instructions for the jury. We don't know how long those instructions will be. But the point is, certainly we think by this afternoon, this trial tomorrow will be in the hands of the jury.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how quickly they come out with a verdict for these three men. I mean, given how much all of this has played out in the public eye ever since last year, perhaps this is going to be something very open or shut. But I have a feeling that this might take a little longer, especially given some of the really tough things that have been said over the last couple of days that I'm sure we're going to be talking about in a little bit, especially what we heard from one of the lawyers representing Laura Hogue, who represents Greg McMichael. Some of the comments she said about Ahmaud Arbery that I think a lot of people viewed as pretty racist.
Yeah, you know, we're gonna talk about that. In fact, we ought to go ahead and start with that, Andra, because we know that it's interesting that in the courtroom, race, certainly on the prosecutorial side, has not been an issue. The prosecutor has been very careful in avoiding talking about this in terms of race, although yesterday in her closing arguments, she did mention, she did for the first time say at one point, this is about three white men chasing a black man. But let's go to what Tamar just talked about. Laura Hogue, in her closing arguments, was making the case that that Ahmaud Arbery was not the innocent jogger people assumed, although no evidence was presented in the trial to give that impression. And let's just listen to the comment that has really, really sparked controversy. Here we come.
Turning Ahmaud Arbery into a victim after the choices that he made does not reflect the reality of what brought Ahmaud Arbery to Satilla Shores in his khaki shorts with no socks to cover his long, dirty toenails.
Andra, I mean, among other things, that's just such a strange visual representation to offer to the jury. Give us your reaction to what you heard.
Well, I think first it's offensive, and I'll get back to that part in a second. But let me try to guess what she was trying to say. I think she was trying to say that because he was running with no socks on, he was not out to be jogging, right? He was there to trespass and to do no good, because if he were a serious jogger, he would have had socks on. I think that that in and of itself is a value judgment that you don't know. When I am on my treadmill in my house, I actually don't wear sneakers, right? It's my choice to do it that way. And so, you know, you don't know if his socks were all dirty or if he didn't have socks, but either way, that's none of your business. So I think she is trying to say again that he's out of place. He shouldn't have been there. And his character says that he's not doing what the prosecutors are saying that he was doing. And so I think she wants to cast doubt in that particular way. I don't know, you know, if any of the jurors jog, you know, whether or not that would resonate. You know, I'm sure there are some people who run, you know, without wearing socks. There have been, you know, runners, famous runners who ran without shoes because they thought it was more comfortable and natural in that particular way. So I don't think that it landed the way that she intended to, even before we get to the racial element of it. I didn't know that one had to clean their feet before they took off running. So I think that that's the other thing. And to tie it to long, dirty toenails, again, is going back to some really old, old, pernicious stereotypes about Black hygiene and other kinds of things that were used to justify why Blacks should be, you know, enslaved, why Blacks were, inferior to whites, and just other kinds of things that just, like, don't matter. Like, lots of people, like, you know, have dirty toenails or toenails that need to be cut before they go run. That should have nothing to do with this particular case. And it reinforces this idea that Ahmaud Arbery stood out because people were uncomfortable with the fact that he was a black man running through this neighborhood. And that is the reason why, you know, he was targeted in this case in the way that other people aren't. And that's not Arbery's problem. That is the defendant's problem in this particular case. And it's our problem as a society that we should be able to allow black people to go take a jog through a white neighborhood without having to worry about their lives being endangered because of it.
Thomas, let me add a couple of more lines from her. I'll read these from what Laura Hogue said about Ahmaud Arbery to expand this vision of him that she created for the jury. She said, quote, "A beautiful teenager with a broad smile and a crooked baseball cap can go astray. He can deteriorate and lose his way, and years later he can end up creeping into a home that is not his own and running away instead of facing the consequences. No one is saying that Ahmaud Arbery deserved to die for whatever it was he was doing inside 220 Satilla Drive. That's not why he died. He died because, for whatever inexplicable, illogical reason, instead of staying where he was, he chose to fight, creeping into the house, Thomas, a man gone astray, deteriorating. I mean, there was no foundation in testimony that supported any of those observations about Arbery, just to begin the discussion about those comments.
Yeah, no, I've been very perplexed during the trial by the strategy of the defense. This wasn't the first kind of strange thing that they said. I questioned the relevancy, and jumping back to it's all of this kind of it's dog whistling. It's planting an idea in people's heads. It's just very unsettling. I would love to know the strategy behind this. I would love to know how they came to the decision that this is the tack we want to take.
There was CNN reported that there was an audible gasp from the courtroom when the defense attorney mentioned the toenails, and that type of visceral imagery is unfortunately the defense making an emotional based argument that's racist and paints a fear into jurors, while the prosecution is arguing facts which unfortunately are less compelling to people right now. And we're kind of living through this time where if you paint it and narrate it in a way that you're telling a story, whether it's fact or not, folks are going to follow into this. I mean the comment was disgusting. It's a race trope that we see all the time all across the country. The fact that it's so focused and made so pernicious in this trial, shouldn't be shocking to a lot of the individuals that are going through this on a daily basis. At Mundo, we always, do reporting on unfortunate race tropes that are pointed to our community. That, the Mexican that's going to, steal your daughter and take your job. And it's very real to communities of color all around the country. So, whatever's going to happen in the next couple of days with the jury, as outrageous as it may be, if they are found not guilty, it's not going to be a surprise to people who deal with this on again, a daily basis. And we're watching, I think, drama play out that's going to be a razor's edge of where the country is going to go in the future.
Tamar Donikowski, the prosecutor, was very straightforward in her presentation. She laid out her factual arguments in a very, very straightforward and a clear way. Let's just listen to just a little to get a sense of how she spoke to the jury yesterday.
Well, what are they going to tell you? They're going to tell you what Travis said. Oh, he's running toward me. And I could tell he was going to attack me. Is that reasonable? Who brought the shotgun to the party? Who took the shotgun out of the car? Who pointed the shotgun? Guys running away from them for 5 minutes.
So, Tamar, this, of course, speaks to the question of self-defense, an argument which in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, as we know, the jury accepted. Kyle Rittenhouse, the jury decided, had shot and killed two people and wounded a third out of fear for his life. And the New York Times ran a long piece on how hard it is for prosecutors to, in fact, argue self-defense, against self-defense. And the piece says basically that for laws nationally basically all follow the same line in each state. If people reasonably believe they are at risk of death or great bodily harm, they can use deadly force. Most states say that someone who provokes violence or is acting illegally waives the right to self-defense, on the other hand. So that's going to be the key question here, right? Whether or not this was, when you bring a weapon to a chase of a man whose activity you really don't know at all, can you argue self-defense?
And this comes at a time in America when we've been kind of systematically loosening our gun laws over the last, you know, 10, 20 years. And the Supreme Court appears bound to do it again based off a New York case that they heard recently. It makes it really hard to kind of argue against these self-defense laws. And what do you do now when there's also this racial component in all of this? How much... how much of a defense does do prosecutors really have when you have these McMichaels who brought this gun, who you could say, are they going to be courting trouble when they bring something like that? So I think it could be a steeper climb for these prosecutors in these closing arguments.
All right. So let's just spend another couple minutes on this and then move on, because, as I said, we're going to hear the prosecutor's rebuttal in a short time. Thomas, but let's talk about it in the context of the Rittenhouse verdict. Obviously, there are similarities in the cases. I'm wondering, we can't get inside the minds of jurors, but certainly over the weekend, it's unlikely they didn't get some inkling about the Rittenhouse outcome. And I wonder to what extent his acquittal could play into thinking about this trial.
It's impossible to know, but this is definitely sparking a whole bunch of debate about when is self defense and when is it almost provocation. Like Tamar was saying, you got to put yourself in the shoes of Arbery during all this. You're just running around, and all of a sudden you are cornered by people, cornered with a shotgun. And there comes a point where like where is that line? Where is it? And when do you step over it? And how would we really kind of know unless it were that videotape? I really don't know.
Andrew?
So, the jury hasn't even begun to deliberate in, the Ahmaud Arbery case. So, we have no idea what they're going to do or what they're going to say.
Right.
If we look at sort of, what people are going to be doing in the Rittenhouse trial, what I suspect jurors are going to say once they finally come forward and start to explain their case is that when they looked at the video evidence, they were paying a lot of attention about who made the first move in these situations. And so because it didn't look like Rittenhouse was making the first move, he had a credible claim to defense in these particular cases. And I think that that's what got him off. So as much as, I think what people are frustrated by in this case is the idea that he had no business being there in the first place. There was a curfew. He was too young. He shouldn't have had a gun. All of those kinds of things that he managed that weren't actually of the essence of the case. Apparently, if you're not supposed to have a gun, but then you use it to protect yourself, it's okay. And we're not dealing with some of the larger kind of issues about, like, what teenagers should and shouldn't be doing at any given moment. But I think the facts of this case may look a little bit different. And so I think the question is, and we don't know the answer to that question, is whether or not the outcome is going to be the same. Because it's not the type of situation where you're going to have a victim necessarily like lunging at the defendants in the case. And then there are these other, issues that are coming up in the case that I do think make the fact base a little bit different. And we just have to wait to see whether or not the juror processing actually looks any different as a result of it.
But one of the things we do know, Renee, is that another aspect of this case that has been discussed is Georgia's former citizen arrest law, which has now been changed dramatically as a result of this case. We know that the citizens' arrest law in Georgia dates back to the years after the Civil War. And actually, to the Civil War itself, it was an opportunity for plantation owners to go after their slaves and capture them legally, and so we have this long history of a law that was used specifically for white people to capture black people, and here again it comes into play in the Arbery case where the McMichaels and Brian decide that they're within their rights to go after this guy whose behavior they know really nothing about at all. But that is part of what this trial is looking at.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, if you just, as difficult as it may be to put aside the racist overtones of this case, I think Tamar said it, the proliferation of loosening gun laws combined with, you know, these self-defense cases and vigilantes out there puts us in a very, very scary place as a country. You're going to see this type of defense being played out as folks feel emboldened to break the law because they deem themselves scared or afraid. That's subjective. It's, you know, it's seeing this play out here. You know, it's hard to watch, you know, but again, at the same time, I think where does that leave us as a country with how our laws are structured, who is protecting whom, and how the future is going to solidify with bringing justice to people that actually do something wrong.
There's also a question of just how many protections you have as a person, as the person on the other side of that exchange without the gun. So you're going to embolden all these people to go out with their guns and police the situation, even though they're not a law enforcement officer. Does that mean that you have to listen to the person with the gun and make sure that they're the ones who don't feel scared or threatened so that you don't get shot? It makes it hard, I think, or very thorny legal questions about how you protect the other person in that exchange, especially if they're a person of color and the person with the gun is a white person.
All right. Well, we will watch how this unfolds. We'll see at what point the jury gets this case, and we'll see how long it takes them to deliberate. They do have three separate defendants to work through and a number of different charges. So this could go on longer than I think some people expect it to. We'll see, and we'll certainly stay on top of it as the case continues to develop. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way and come back. We've got some really interesting new political news to talk about, and we'll do that in just a moment. We're back on Political Rewind with Professor Andre Gillespie, with Renee Alegria of Mundo Hispanico, Thomas Wheatley of Axios Atlanta, and senior reporter at the AJC, Tamar Hallerman. Well, Tamar, congressional redistricting in Georgia has sparked some really interesting news. We have talked about, and people have known for a while now, that the Republican leadership in the legislature was going to go after the 6th congressional district and try to redraw it so that it's a far more likely Republican district. That's where Lucy McBath is in the middle of serving her second term. And now it has been drawn as a Republican district. The question was, what's Lucy McBath going to do about that? And now we have the answer, Tamar. What is Lucy McBath doing about that?
She's going to go to next door to the 7th District to primary her colleague of the last year or so, Carolyn Bordeaux, in the 7th. Neither one of them technically live in the district right now. Congresswoman McBath has mentioned moving from her current place in Marietta East Cobb into the new Gwinnett-based district. Carolyn Bordeaux was drawn now. She lives just outside the district in Sewanee, but it's going to set up a really nasty primary fight over there that's really going to divide the Democratic Party. There's also plenty of others in the party who are looking at that district as well, including Donna McLeod. Mm-hmm. So that'll set up a pretty bloody battle there. And it'll also be interesting to see now that the 6th district, which for so long has been this crown jewel for Republicans in Georgia. Of course, that's where Newt Gingrich rose to the speakership. That's where Johnny Isaacson charted his path to the U.S. Senate. Now we're going to see a pretty bloody primary, I'm sure, for the Republicans in that district, where already we have people like Meghan Hansen, Jake Evans, but we could also see others like Rich McCormick, who initially was running in the 7th against Carolyn Bordeaux. It's now looking likely that he'll run in the 6th district. So that's what happens when you draw these very safe partisan districts. If you look at the partisan lean of what these redrawn districts are going to be now, the most competitive district is still Democrat plus 10 or, Republican plus 20. So yeah, it goes to show we're not going to have, very competitive races for the general election, but the primaries are going to be bloody in all of these districts.
Yeah, Thomas, it's worth pointing out that the 7th district, Tamar says that we may see more people than Lucy McBath, who's now kind of lost the 6th, moving into the 7th. There may be any number of other Democrats who will challenge in that district. And it's worth pointing out the reason for that. Carolyn Bordeaux ran for that seat twice in a district that was only marginally Democratic. She really went out of her, she took a risk. She went up there. She said, I think I have a chance to win this district. She had to deal with Forsyth County, which was much more Republican. And now that the district has been compacted, there were other Democrats who didn't want to have anything to do with that kind of risk. But now that the district has been compacted, it's almost entirely contained in Gwinnett County, suddenly it becomes fertile ground for a number of Democrats who may want to jump into the race. Right, Thomas?
Yeah. And, Even before this was, there's always been thinking that there was going to be some kind of change like this. And even before it was proposed, there was talk that Carolyn Bordeaux was going to get a primary challenger. I mean, if you look at how she's been in the House, I mean, she's very much been a moderate, she pushed back against Pelosi on, the infrastructure package trifecta with the budget framework. And what I'm really asking myself is, how are voters in this new district going to respond to that? Is there that real appetite for someone who's, I would say, more progressive and who's more willing to put up a fight on these traditional progressive issues? And who else joins other than Lucy McBath? I don't know, but it's going to be fascinating.
Andra?
So, one, I don't understand what Congresswoman McBath is doing. Strategically, this just does not make a whole lot of sense. Like, I understand her looking at the tea leaves and thinking that she's not going to win a general election in the 6th district. But the idea of moving to a district that you don't have roots in, right? Like, you had roots in the 6th district, and now you're going to move over to the east side of Metro Atlanta, where you're going to have to develop those relationships, I think, is different. And she might be looking at the fact that Carolyn Bordeaux moved into the district so that she could run, and sees that as a vulnerability. I agree with Thomas that Bordeaux was likely going to get a challenge on her left flank because this district has become more reliably Democratic. The thing about McBath, though, is that McBath really can't make that type of claim in the same way. Bordeaux is more visibly visibly moderate. But if I look at sort of Poole Rosenthal nominate scores, which are basically about party line voting, and so we could talk about the ways that those look a little bit different, McBath is actually more centrist than Bordeaux is. So I just, none of this makes any sense to me. This doesn't strike me as the most strategic move. And I feel bad for Congresswoman McBath that, you know, she's had her district change around her and that the challenges are harder. But that just raises other questions about, okay, so who's now going to fill in her place in the 6th district? So I'm just kind of befuddled by the whole move.
Yeah, Renee, I want to use a term here without meaning it in a disparaging way. I hope I can. McBath showed us a long time ago that she picks her the races to run in a relatively opportunistic way. She initially, we recall, before she won the race, even entered the race that led her to her seat in Congress, was planning to run for the state legislature. An opportunity opened up in the 6th that she thought gave her a chance to win up there, and so she picked up stakes from the legislative battle and went to the congressional race. And the reason she says she's going to go ahead and challenge Carolyn Bordeaux is this. McBath was quoted as saying, "I refuse to let Brian Kemp, the National Rifle Association, and the Republican Party keep me from fighting. They're not going to have the last word." So, you know, there you go.
Well, look, what are we doing? We're talking about McBath. And she's going to be the focus of the discussion through the primary because she's made this bold move. Well, I agree. It doesn't make a lot of strategic sense. We're talking about it, you know, and it's part of her whole ethos as a very compelling candidate. Her story, people connect with her. She connects with people. Her son was killed due to gun violence. You know, I mean, you can go on and on why she is a representative that, again, touches the heart of people in Georgia. So it is going to be interesting to see how it works out, how, you know, Bordeaux responds to all this. But, you know, I mean, let's face it, we're talking about it and we're talking about her. And it's a good way to launch her campaign.
Tamar?
I'm less surprised. Lucy McBath is a woman hyper-focused on one issue, which is gun control. And over the last, you know, couple of years since she's been elected to Congress, she's been approached multiple times about running statewide, and she's turned it down because she's so hyper-focused on this issue. And Congress is going to be the place where a lot of these battles are going to be fought, especially should the Supreme Court be gutting a lot of these laws that the states already have on the books. So it's not surprising to me that she's going to do what she needs to do to be able to stay in Congress and have a front row seat on this issue, especially if you have a Democratic administration that can be a working partner to that. It is interesting, you know, with Bordeaux when she first ran in 2018 against Rob Woodall and just how different that district was back then. You know, Woodall was winning re-election with 20%+ of the vote every time. It was so safely Republican. So I can see why she would want to kind of take that perceived moderate tack. Anyway, it's so interesting how much now that district has changed. It's going to become Democrat plus 22. After all these changes are approved. So it'll be interesting, you know, just how far left a lot of these candidates could be in a primary challenge. And I'm curious how much it'll ultimately push her to the left, especially if party leaders end up coalescing behind McBath or McLeod or any of these other challengers of hers.
Meanwhile, Thomas, Carolyn Bordeaux could have sort of anticipated this could happen, and even before Lucy McBath made her announcement, Bordeaux revealed that she had won the endorsement of Andy Young, who came to her side on this fight. So she was preparing for it. She kind of saw it coming. Her comment to the AJC was, "I fought hard for this district, and I'm not giving it up easily." Essentially,
yeah, and it's groups have raised concerns about this in the past that, not only do these kind of primaries with big name candidates going against each other, do they kind of drain resources? Do they drain energy? But they also contribute to, these elections that aren't competitive. You know, they're primary elections that where the winner is decided then and there, and you just get these increasingly polarized states, state legislatures, and that could very well, be the case here. I mean, Carolyn Bordeaux sounds like she is really ready to fight. I mean, like, she didn't waste any time. So it favors them. But if a Republican jumps in, they're going to be facing somebody that that probably is going to be pretty tired by the general election.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to see two interesting battles in those congressional districts, the 6th and the 7th in the months ahead. And we'll watch them, of course. Andra, I hadn't been paying as much attention. I'd been watching the 6th to see what was going to happen to McBath. I had not been paying as much attention to the new lines that the legislature drew for the 14th district, Marjorie Taylor Greene's district up there in North Georgia. It turns out that they brought the district down into a portion of Cobb County it's Southwest Cobb, I think, that's long been represented by David Scott, the Democrat. And there are going to be Democrats in that district who are really going to be upset to suddenly find they're represented by Marjorie Taylor Greene.
I think that this is, definitely what's surprising me. I think part of it's done because you've got to make sure that your districts are equally, are proportional in terms of population. That's part of the, part of the calculus that's going on here. And you have Republicans drawing district lines who aren't necessarily, concerned about trying to keep traditionally Democratic areas together in this instance. I think the big question will be whether or not Marjorie Taylor Greene actually ends up moderating in some way, shape, or form as a result of having a more diverse district, having a district that where you have this cache of Democratic voters. I'm not holding my breath for that. So let's just be, very clear about, where I think this is going. But again, what this could be setting us up for sort of in the next decade is that as Southwest Cobb, grows and continues to add to the diversity of the district, right, it might actually add to sort of the possibility that Marjorie Taylor Greene can no longer safely pull all of the stunts that she's pulling. And given the fact that she has no committee assignments, given the fact that she mainly wants to be on TV, I would hazard to look at her constituent services and saying that ultimately that could be her Achilles heel in the same way that it hurt people like Cynthia McKinney, the same way it's hurt other members of Congress who were, perceived as kind of being a little out to lunch and not necessarily engaged in what's going on in their district. So, Green, if she was smart, she would learn, one, how to work with people so that people would let her on committees, but she would also learn to be attentive to people in her district and to understand that that doesn't just include people in Rome, that includes people who are further south who don't necessarily sort of take a liking to how she operates and what her style is.
Renee, the AJC describes that new 14th district this way. The new boundaries make it slightly less conservative, yet still a safe haven for Republicans. But instead of snatching parts of rural Harrelson County and Pickens counties, which would, of course, been Republican, the new boundaries curl around exurban Paulding County to pick up portions of Southwest Cobb that include Austell and Powder Springs, which also happen to be some of the most solidly Democratic and most diverse portions of the suburban county. It's the home to the first black mayor in Cobb County and the launching pad for the county's first African-American commissioner. So part of the problem becomes here that people who are now find themselves in that new 14th, African-Americans, minorities, suddenly find themselves essentially disenfranchised because the chances that they're going to be able to elect a congressperson who represents their point of view is virtually nil.
It'll be very interesting to see just the population breakdown of that portion of Cobb versus the more rural areas that Green has her base. I do think that anger drives people to vote, and I think that there are going to be a lot of angry engaged Democrats that are not going to accept Green as being their representative to Congress. I think she should be very nervous about her contentious future in her district, whether it is still reliably Republican. Still, she's going to have people protesting. She's going to have to actually open up and dialogue with people, which Andra said, you know, very, very eloquently. She doesn't do that very well, you know. So we'll see how that works. But, you know, I think the overall point of how these gerrymandered maps become public and how they just destabilize all the time local communities into just shifting again how they're supposed to work and looking at a representative government structure that is in peril. There was a report yesterday or the day before that for the first time the United States is backsliding in their democracy, in our democracy. And I think, you know, this is one of those other points that show just how dangerous we're approaching a future with our democracy intact.
All right. Well, it's going to be interesting to watch Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think Tamar, you don't have any hope that she's going to moderate at all, right?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Her platform and her influence comes with being, you know, saying outrageous things and being out there on social media and some of these far right news outlets. So I don't see her moderating at all. And I really don't necessarily think that a Democratic candidate can seriously challenge her given the makeup of this district. What I do think this could open up, though, is maybe a Republican primary challenge and a Republican who's a little more middle of the road. Maybe this opens the door for, I can't remember his first name, Cowan. He was the surgeon who was in the primary runoff against Marjorie Taylor Greene. Someone like that, who maybe you see a lot of these, you know, Democrats of color in Cobb County and Paulding County trying to coalesce a little bit behind somebody who's a little more establishment, who at least won't be saying, you know, racist and really flagrant things all the time.
All right. We'll watch it. Thomas, you want to get in the last word before our break?
Oh yeah, no, I'm just wondering. I'm trying to wrap my head around. Yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who moderates, and my brain is just exploding. I can't imagine that reality. And Renee touched on a great point. This is also one of those reasons why advocates say that it's important that these maps get a little oxygen, get put out there so people can see them, because this thing came out and it was a total shock. And now you've got, you know, county commissioners who are thinking, like, how do we work with this congressperson? You've got voters who are like, this person, it really doesn't represent me. So,
yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point, that there are local government officials who are affected by this as well. I'm glad you got that in before the break. Let's get our final break, the show, out of the way. When we come back, yeah, you know, we're right on top of the Atlanta mayoral runoff election, and the AJC has a poll with interesting data that we can talk about after these messages. Here we go again with the final segment of Political Rewind. Tamar Hallerman, the AJC, working with University of Georgia School of Public and International Affairs, has released a new poll of the mayor's race, 802 likely voters. They were in the field November 11th to 19th, just to get the terms straight. The poll shows, just on the top line, that this is still a very close race. Andre Dickens has moved a little bit in front of Felicia Moore, 43% to 37%. It's outside the margin of error, but it's still a very fragile sort of lead, to say the least, Tamar.
Yeah, a couple data points that really stuck out to me. First of all, that about a fifth of the electorate, a pretty significant portion, are still undecided in the final days of these races. So I think that should be encouraging for both candidates, even though Dickens is leading more in this poll, that gives her more than enough space to catch up. Another thing that was interesting to me was that among, you know, the poll respondents who said they voted for Moore in the, you know, on November 2nd, There was a larger amount who voted for Moore who said they were open to, or they were planning to switching to Dickens or open to doing it anyway, much more so than the Dickens people who are open to switching to Moore. And that's very interesting to me because obviously Moore ended up getting something like 40% of the November 2nd vote. You know, she was the leader by quite a bit. Dickens and Kasim Reed were trailing, I think, with the low 20s, maybe 22-23%. And so if you look at that, you'd think Moore would have this in the bag. But it goes to show that there are a lot of people who have been open to switching to Dickens after all of this. Maybe people who voted for Moore initially, thinking she was the one who could win, who could beat Kasim Reed, who I think we all thought would end up in this runoff. So a lot of people open to switching to Dickens.
It's no surprise, Thomas, that crime, according to the people who responded to the poll, remains the major issue in the race by far. 47% said it's the top issue. Only 21% said affordable housing, which was second, was the top issue. And even though it was only 21%, there are enough people who are concerned about affordable housing that candidates have had to establish positions on this that people are watching pretty closely.
Yeah, well, it's one of the biggest issues that Atlanta has been facing, and I think really will face for, honestly, the next generation. I mean, because the more affordable housing you build, the more affordable housing the subsidies expire. So it's really just kind of bailing out water from a canoe with a hole in it. And Dickens has been probably the most vocal person on city council for the longest period on this issue. And because Felicia Moore has been in a council president position where she's not really in the position to introduce legislation, it's largely leading meetings and assigning committees, she hasn't had as many chances and opportunities to get out and talk about that. So she's really having to play catch up. One other interesting thing that I saw in that poll was people aged 18 to 29 showed a preference for Moore, which really surprised me because Moore is really speaking on more constituent services. Government is broken. I'm the one who can fix it. Andre Dickens is really talking about big picture ideas and like the vision of Atlanta. I want to save the soul of Atlanta. That's really how they're differentiating it or distinguishing themselves right now.
Renee?
Oh, geez, polls, right? They drive us nuts because there's so much interesting data in reading them, you know? And then at the day of, it's like, what just happened? Dickens has gotten more former mayor, city council endorsements, Young, Shirley Franklin. I think like six other council members have swung behind Dickens. He's got momentum, I think, and timing up to that day is about momentum in politics. And Gay and Reed supporters are going and kind of, getting behind Dickens. And Tamar pointed out that very interesting stat, right, where folks in the Dickens camp are not switching over to Moore, but folks in the Moore camp are switching over to Dickens, which just goes to show that solid base of folks who are very loyal to what his vision is for Atlanta. I think we're at that crossroads in the city where we need someone that does have an altered vision of what we're going to be. And that's hopeful and the future, and Dickens is tapping into that, where I don't think Moore is as much.
All right, Andra, I wanted you to go last on observations about this because this is really where you shine. You understand this stuff, I think, better than any of us do.
So how to say this in a couple of minutes. So first, this race is still statistically tied. So given the fact that the margin of error is 3.5 points, Dickens would have to have a lead of more than 7 for him to truly statistically be ahead, and he's only up by 6. So I think that this race is still anybody's, and this is really going to come down to turnout. So who remembers to vote on Tuesday after Thanksgiving, I think is going to be a big deal. And who's banked enough votes now in this early voting period, I think is going to be really, really crucial. This looks like it's breaking down to sort of a classic de-racialized case. So you've got two black candidates, one of whom is clearly more favored by white voters than others. So Felicia Moore has that vote, might erode a little bit because of the statements that she made after the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict. right? And that's a classic problem when you are the transcendent candidate, is that if you say something that ticks off part of your base, they may defect. We'll have to wait to see whether or not that actually matters a whole lot in this particular context. But what I am seeing from the poll is that, again, as Renee said, Reid and gay voters have defected to Dickens, and it looks like Dickens is actually banking strong support in the African-American community. So where all three of them split that black vote on November 2nd, it looks like Dickens is actually picking up more of that vote, which is why he is competitive at this particular point. But again, you know, given that this is likely going to be a low salience election, whichever one of these candidates has the best turnout operation is in the stronger position to win.
So is there any reason, Tamar and Thomas, why reporters, journalists ask Andra Gillespie for quotes for stories? She turns out such interesting information in soundbite form. Thank you very much for that, Andra. That was terrific. And thank you for being here. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, Andra. Renee, I'll agree the same to you. May your Thanksgiving be restful and happy. Tamar, Thomas Wheatley, the same to the two of you. Have a great, great day on Thursday. We're out of time for today, but we're back again tomorrow for another Political Rewind, of course. Until then, I'm Bill Nygut. Take care. Please stay healthy. Bye-bye, everybody.